And now, Canada Hoops, hosted by Maddie Ireland.
Welcome back to Canada Hoops, everyone. It's your boy, Maddie. Thank you for your tremendous support last season. Please continue to like, share, and subscribe to Canada Hoops. It's a true privilege to kick off season two of the podcast with today's guest. He represents Toronto, Ontario. He's a former Western Mustang. He's the lead announcer for college basketball on ESPN. You can catch him on Rogers Sportsnet calling the Toronto Blue Jays. He has covered and called Canada basketball. He's an iconic voice in sports broadcasting, a proud Canadian. He is Dan Schulman. Dan, welcome to Canada Hoops.
Thank you, Maddie. Thank you for having me. And yes, I lied. My favorite part was that last part. He is a proud Canadian because I am definitely a proud Canadian. I've worked a lot professionally down in the U.S. and I've loved everything I've done with ESPN and have friends and family all over the U.S., but yes, I am a proud Canadian.
Well, I had to put that in there, and I know that's a big part of why I think you were keen to come on and share your love of Canadian basketball, and we'll get into that throughout the podcast. How are things, Dan? Take us through this past year and a half or so for you and your family with the pandemic, you know, both personally and professionally. How have you had to pivot and readjust, so to speak?
Yeah, like everybody, life is different than it was, and we'll see what it turns into over the next couple of years. But I consider myself very fortunate. Everybody close to me is healthy, thank God, and everybody is finding their way. I have four kids. It's impacted all of them, I guess, in slightly different ways, but Everybody is doing great. My oldest son got married this summer. It was supposed to be a bigger wedding. It wound up being seven people, but that doesn't matter. All that matters is that they're a wonderful couple and they're happy, and I got to be there, which is great. But knock on wood, everybody is doing okay, and I hope we're closer to the finish line than the starting line on this thing.
Yeah, agreed. It's been a long haul for a lot of us, and you know, I think it's important to take time to reflect on the little things and appreciate what really matters throughout this period. We truly appreciate you joining us. Like I mentioned before, recorded, and I was just hoping we could kind of get into your story and your love of sports. You know, what was little Dan like, and just kind of how you grew up and your exposure to sports and how that love of sports grew.
Sure. So little Dan was Danny, and actually I'm still Danny to most people. I prefer Danny. So although when I come on air, I say, hi, this is Dan Schulman. Like, I'm happier if the people I work with say, hey, Danny, how about this? So, so little Danny grew up in Toronto, loved sports. I mean, you could not love sports more than I did. Unfortunately, my love for them was way, way, way stronger than my ability to play them. Like, I was okay at this and decent at that, but that's it. But I grew up in the north end of Toronto in Willowdale, near the Bayview and Steeles area of Willowdale. It's part of North York, I guess, too. So, and loved basketball. It's funny because, so I was born in 1967. I'm 54 years old. So, you know, as I'm really getting into sports in the 70s, basketball is not nearly the thing in Canada then that it is now. You know that. It's miles removed. Like, nobody had even, the Raptors weren't even a dream at that point. So, but my dad was a pretty good basketball player. He played at Harvard Collegiate in downtown Toronto, and they were the city champs in 1954 and 1955. And my dad was the starting center on both of those teams, which is funny to me, because he's like 6'1½", but I guess it was different back in the 50s than it is now. And he had, I remember when I was a kid, he's a lefty, I'm a lefty too, he had a little running hook shot. And I guess that's how you get your shot off when you're a 6'1½" center. And he wasn't a big scorer. I think he was more the, you know, a good defender and a great teammate and all that. But nonetheless, he was a starter on a team that won two city championships. So relative to other kids that I grew up with, I was probably a little bit more into basketball than most kids. Hockey was unquestionably my first love as a kid. Enormous Maple Leaf fan in the 70s. Daryl Sittler, Lanny McDonald, Boreas Salming, all that. But I did grow up with, you know, knowing the names of John Havlicek and Pete Maravich and JoJo White. You didn't see much of it on TV. Again, I was a little kid, and in the 70s, you couldn't see much. But by the time the 80s rolled around, both on a college basketball level and an NBA level, I was hooked. So by the time I was a teenager, you know, by the time Magic got to the NBA and Larry Bird got to the NBA and then Michael got to the NBA, you know, through the 80s, so the late great Laker teams, great Celtic teams, great Bulls teams, then the great Pistons teams. I think that was an incredible NBA era, phenomenal era. And I was all in then. And then I started getting into college basketball hard, really hard. My grandparents used to have a place in Florida, and we'd go down on March break every year, and everybody else would go to the beach, and I'd stay inside and watch March Madness on their television. So, you know, when NC State won it in 83, beating Phi Slamma Jamma, Georgetown with Patrick Ewing, Villanova beating Georgetown, Indiana beating Syracuse. Again, I think the 80s, both on a college and pro level, were fantastic basketball eras. So, short question, very long answer. I apologize. I loved all sports. I played as many as I could. Had a hoop on the driveway back as a kid, back when nobody had a hoop on the driveway. So basketball was always a big thing for me. I never could have predicted that it would be as big a part of my adult life as it's been. But basketball has always been very, very special to me.
That's cool. So your dad's a bit of a role model in terms of the game. You know, I always kind of ask people when they are growing up and starting to play basketball, whatever level, you know, having that role model right in front of you, did you always try to be like him in terms of his game? And then there were other role models off the court too, but, you know, what was that influence like from him?
Yeah, we played a little bit. It's funny. My dad was a dentist and he worked crazy long hours. So most of my time on the driveway, my dad wasn't there. I don't have a ton of memories of my dad, you know, feeding me passes or beating me in one-on-one or something like that. I know it did happen, but I don't have a ton of memories. But I do know, I do remember my mom driving me around to this program and the after-school program, summer camp, a week at this camp to play basketball. And again, I wasn't very good. Like I was, you know, just good enough to make the high school team, but didn't play a ton. That's the level I was at. So, but I loved playing. And I'm 54 years old and I still hack around with my buddies and we play once or twice a week when nobody's broken anything. Nobody's, you know, nobody's got a cast on or anything like that. So, but there were a couple of kids in the neighborhood, my age or a year older, who played basketball, but it was really once, you know, once I got to be about 12, 13 years old, when my parents enrolled me in the odd program or the odd summer camp. But to me, like I realized my limitations as a player early. And again, never thought I would get into a career as a broadcaster. So there was a big stretch where basketball for me was just watching it on TV, like everybody else, just loving it. And, you know, it wasn't like I saw Michael do something and then went out in the driveway and tried to emulate that. Like that wasn't happening. So playing above the rim was never in the cards for me. But but it was always, you know, again, being a kid with a basket on your a hoop on your driveway, it was unusual then back in 77, 78, 79. And it was nice. I didn't play hockey as a kid. I played a ton of road hockey, street hockey, basement hockey, whatever other kind of hockey you could play. But, you know, so the driveway was like my playground. That's just where, you know, you got some time to kill. You got some energy you want to burn off or whatever. Just go out in the driveway and shoot. And, as long as I left the garage open so that the ball didn't mark up the garage, I didn't get in trouble. I had to make sure the garage was open and the car was out of the garage before I was allowed to play.
That's cool. If we can, we'll get into a little bit of the start in terms of broadcasting and we'll go back to Western and you're calling basketball and football for the Mustangs on CHRW Radio in London. You know, what are your best memories of starting out in those experiences?
So it was never intended to become a career.
Right.
It was 100% that my parents instilled in my sisters and me, have an extracurricular activity, get involved, don't just go to school.
Right.
And I actually loved sports, like I mentioned. So first day of Frosh Week, 1985 at Western, I lined up at the Western Gazette office, which was and I believe still is a great newspaper at Western. And there were like 100 kids in line before me. And I stood there for about a half an hour and I said, man, this ain't happening.
Right.
And I started walking back towards my dorm and walked past a door at the main central building on campus, walked past a door and all it said was Radio Western. And I knocked on the door and somebody said, come in. And I walked in and I said, is this the campus radio station? And they said, yeah. And I said, do you do sports? And they said, yep. And I said, do you need volunteers? And they said, yep. And that's how it started. If I had walked in the other direction, I'm not sure I'd be talking to you. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be talking to you today. So they had some openings. And again, this is 36 years ago. The world's a different place.
Right.
It's not like I've got a son who goes to Syracuse. He's an aspiring broadcaster. Cool. He's in a phenomenal program. It's all laid out in front of them. You know what the steps are that you have to take. I was a math major. I wasn't in journalism or broadcasting or anything. I just happened to knock on the door and they needed some help. So I got a chance to start doing football and basketball games. And I remember I did a lot of basketball. I did some football, but again, in whatever circle I was in back then, I was kind of a quote basketball guy because I just loved it so much. So I got to do a lot of Western basketball games. My memories are, I can still remember for sure four of the starting five, I think. Pod Armstrong and Kevin Armstrong were brothers and they were the starting backcourt. Chris Cavender, Pete Van de Bovenkamp, they were really good. Western was really good. And one year they made it out to Halifax and for the Nationals. And I got to go out to Halifax.
Nice.
And I stayed in a family's home. I don't remember who they were. There was no money in the budget to put me in a hotel. So somebody knew somebody and I stayed with a family and I called a bunch of games out in Halifax. But I thought it was the most exciting in the world, calling university basketball or university football games back then. And again, even at this point, I wasn't thinking about it as a career. It was just a hobby at that point. But I thought it was really cool to be sitting courtside and calling basketball games.
Yeah, no kidding. And just a quick shout out to Western. I played 2001 Canada Summer Games there. Great time, great memories, great campus. So
great city, yeah.
Yeah, great city. I just wanted to touch on the 94 World Championships in Toronto. I know you called those. That was considered a bit of a showcase, perhaps, of what was to come with the basketball in the country and the Raptors and the Grizzlies entering the NBA a year later. What do you make of that tournament? Was there a lot of vibe and hype to sort of really launch the game in the country and just early memories of Steve Nash before that was 2 years before he got drafted?
Yeah, I think so. It was, on a personal note, it was one of the biggest breaks I've ever gotten in my life. The demo tape that got me my college basketball job at ESPN was the World Championships in Toronto in 1994.
Wow.
Because I don't believe I did any basketball between Western and the World Championships, play-by-play. Like, there was no play-by-play that I know of to do in Canada back then. I started working in radio in Barrie, and then I got to CJCL, and it became The Fan. I might have done one or two NBA exhibition games on the radio, but, you know, to do games, I think it was on CTV, to do games on national television was huge. So... It was a big deal. And I remember, Rick Fox played for Canada in that tournament. They had a heartbreaking loss to Greece. I don't remember the specifics or the score. I think Canada finished seventh, but had they won that game, you know, maybe then they're in that top four and maybe playing for bronze kind of mix, something like that.
Right.
I worked with Leo Routens. That's, I believe, when Leo and I met. We've been good friends ever since. And I remember a little kid named Andy Routens running around on the court making 20 footers. And I said, damn, who's that? And Leo said, that's my kid. Nice. And then, however many years later, 15 years later, I did, I don't know how many of Andy's games at Syracuse, which was really fun. So,
no kidding.
So that's cool to see. So Leo and I had a great time. I thought it was a really good showcase. And you're right. I remember Steve Nash coming in, and this was young Steve Nash. And my memory is that he was not the starting point guard on that team. I think Ronnie McMahon still? I think Ronnie McMahon might have been the starting point guard on that
team. He was, yeah.
Yeah. And Nash would come in, you know, to spell him for a few minutes here, a few minutes there. And I'm not claiming to be smarter than anybody else, but it was like, who's this kid? This kid's really good. And you could see the seeds of what he would become then. And again, this is just before, this is February of 94, I want to, it's in 94, right? It was in, so it's before the Raptors and the Grizzlies are a thing. Right. And again, it wasn't as easy to see games on TV or dial up things on the internet. You know, it was a different world back then. But I remember seeing him and saying, I don't know what he's going to be, but this kid's good.
Was that opportunity to call the world a bit of a launch to you going to TSN a year later and starting to, you, because you covered a lot of sports at TSN when you were there?
Yeah, it's actually separate. So I don't want to bore you with too long of a story, but okay. let me remember my own timeline here. So I started, so Jim Hewson, who is still one of the lead voices for Hockey Night in Canada, back then he was doing hockey and the Blue Jays.
Okay.
And then Jim decided to leave the Blue Jays and just focus on hockey. So the hockey, the Blue Jay job came up for the 95 season, and I applied for the Blue Jay job. Didn't get it. And then 3 months later, TSN called me back and offered it to me. So I don't know who they tried to hire or why they didn't hire him. And the funny part is I've never been choice A for any job I've gotten. I've always been B, C, or D, but I've gotten lucky. So they called me back. And in 95, I started doing Blue Jay games on TSN. In September of 95, ESPN called me. I had done a little ESPN radio work.
Right.
Through a quirky, fluky story I won't bore you with. In September of 95, ESPN called me and said, hey, so-and-so is not feeling well. They're sick or something. They can't make a game. Can you fill in on an ESPN baseball game for us tomorrow? And it was an off day for the Blue Jays, so I did the ESPN game. They called me back and they thanked me and they said, do you do any other sports? And I said, well, I did this World Championships of Basketball last year in Toronto. Right. And they said, so this is now like September of 95. And they said, can you send in a demo tape? And I said, sure. And I didn't have a demo tape, so I made a demo tape back then. And I sent it to ESPN, and they called me about a week later. And they said, would you like to do college basketball for ESPN? And I said, sure. So everything's kind of connected, but not really, if you know what I mean. So,
right.
But so my life, like in 94, I was working at the Fan radio. And the World Championships were like a one-off. And then in 95, all of a sudden, I was a Blue Jay guy and an ESPN guy. Like, it happened that fast. Never saw it coming. Never could have imagined it. And it was wonderful. And the chance to do, Major League Baseball and college basketball, two deep, deep loves of mine. I've always loved the NBA. And I did the NBA a little bit in Canada and I did it for 5 years for ESPN as well. But I've always been an enormous college basketball fan. So that getting that phone call saying, would you like to do college basketball for ESPN? Like, you almost think you're getting punked. It's such a good phone call. So it was a wonderful opportunity.
With respect to covering college basketball for ESPN, your time doing that, I just want to talk a little bit of Canadian players coming up through Division One. Who stands out the most to you coming from Canada with respect to their careers down there?
You know, I'm very fortunate in that I get to do a lot of Duke basketball games. So also, and maybe so there's some recency bias here, but you know, the RJ Zion year, I think I did 14 of Duke's, however, 38 game, whatever they played. Right. So, and I did the summer before, and I know you'll remember this, Duke came to Canada and played some exhibition games up here. Right. And Jay Billis and I did those for ESPN Plus, and I think they ran on TSN as well.
They did.
So we did the two games in Toronto and the one in Montreal. So, you know, to see that much RJ up close that year was fantastic. And he had a great year, and he was the third pick in the draft. And, you know, had Zion not existed, I think that, you know, people would look at RJ even differently than they do. You know, he's obviously a very special talent. There's no doubt about that. He's got all kinds of skills. So RJ Barrett is one that comes to mind. I remember, this is going back a few more years, I remember being at a Texas practice, and I always will ask the coach or the SID, if there's a Canadian player, I will always say, hey, I'm sure they don't know or care who I am. I said, but I'm from near where they're from, and I'd like to go introduce myself to them. And I remember introducing myself to Corey Joseph and Tristan Thompson. Yeah. And just having a great conversation with them. And it was funny, many years later, you know, I'm trying to remember how many years Corey was at Texas. Two, I think, maybe. But, you know, once they go to the NBA, like, I lose touch with, like, they're gone, right? I don't see them again. Right. And then two years ago, a friend of mine who's a big charitable guy, donor, sponsor, all that sort, he said, hey, I've got floors for the Raptor game. You want to come? I said, sure, I'd love to come. And they were playing, I think Corey was with Sacramento then, but whoever Corey was with. So we're sitting down in the first row, and it's during the national anthems. And I'm just standing there, and I look over at Corey, and Corey looks at me. And I hadn't seen Corey in 12 years, maybe at that point. And Corey looks at me, and he just did like that, like just like, I remember. And I did it back, and I was like, that's cool. Corey remembers me. And it was great. So, you know, Corey and Tristan were guys I got a chance to know. Did a bunch of Andrew Wiggins games at Kansas,
right?
Obviously. Never really got to know him. Very, you know, quiet, introverted kind of guy. But there have been so many. I mean, Nick Stauskas, right? Like the career Nick Stauskas had at Michigan was great. Quincy Guerrier, who's still playing now at Syracuse, and now he's going to Oregon. I mean, there have been so many of them. When I started, you know, if you had a good player at Canisius or Niagara or something like that, you were like, man, that's pretty cool. And now you got, you know, Melvin Edgem wins Big 12 Player of the Year at Iowa State, right? You got Conference Players of the Year. You've got, we didn't mention Anthony Bennett. You got first overall picks. You've got All-Americans, and it's been great, and it's not going away. I mean, I watched the U19 tournament. I'm sure you did as well. And sometimes I'm a little late to the party until a guy shows up in college. Sometimes I don't know as much about them as 16, 17 year olds as I should. And then it's like, wow, who's this Josh Primo dude? How do I get Alabama on my schedule? And then he's a first round pick, you know, six months later. So, selfishly, I wish some of them would stick around college a little longer, because that's what I do. But if they're good enough to go, go.
Yeah, for sure. Kentucky just landed the number one recruit, Shadon Sharp there. Hopefully you'll get some Kentucky games. He looks really good.
Another one. I didn't mention Jamal Murray or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I mean, two of the absolute best, two of the best players we have. And not to bounce around too much, but the first time I saw Jamal was at the Pan Am Games that I did, whatever year that was, 15, I think.
2015,
In Toronto. And to see him as whatever he was, 18 years old then, to go out and play the way that he did against the U.S. and Argentina and Brazil, and it was, you know, if Jamal Murray had been a stock, I was buying right then. I'd have put some money down on Jamal Murray then. And you could see it in Shai too, as soon as he got to Lexington.
Yeah, for sure. So 2011, Dan, named the National Sportscaster of the Year by the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association, making you the first Canadian-born announcer to be so honored. Tell me about that feeling and just, you know, being recognized by your peers as the best that year to do it.
That was overwhelming, because it's a U.S. thing. As you said, it's not a Canadian thing, and I'm just as honored by Canadian things, but it's a bigger pond down there, obviously. And my recollection is that I got a phone call. It's right around Christmas or New Year's when you find out about it. And I got a phone call from Dave Gorin, who I know, telling me that I had won the award. I don't even remember if I knew that I was a finalist for the award. I know much more about the process since than I knew before. And he said, so we're going to need you to come down to North Carolina. We've got a banquet in June, and you'll be there with the Writer of the Year and this year's Hall of Fame broadcaster inductee and Hall of Fame writer inductee. And like Bob Costas was the Hall of Fame broadcaster going in that year. And I was the national award winner for that year. And the writers were great writers as well. And it was a banquet for like 600 people. So I took some family down, and I also took, I asked the program director and the news director at the Fan, the two people who literally gave me my start in the business. I said, can you guys come down? Can you fly down? And the program director, I said, can you introduce me? Cause I said, I wouldn't be here without you. And
cool.
It was very, very special. It was, you know, I was a math major who just happened to knock on a door that said Radio Western, right? So it's not like I was that kid who dreamt of this and this and this growing up. When I decided to try to get into broadcasting about 6 months after I graduated, I did it because I just wanted to have fun. You know, it's nothing noble or anything like that. I just said, I think this looks like it would be really fun. And I knew I wanted to get into sports. So then to get these awards is incredible. It's not something that I have spent a lot of time thinking about, but I think you use the term peers and to be the people who vote on that award. I mean, I now vote on it because once I knew about that organization, I joined it. I'm part of the membership. And so I vote every year as well. To get an award when it's voted on by the people who do what you do. I think it's very special. Just like, you know, if a professional athlete wins an award that's voted on by the writers, that's awesome. But if they win an award that's voted on by the other players in their league, that's even a little more special because those are the people that really understand what you do.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great insight. We appreciate that. And I mentioned this before we recorded, this little cool fact about you just kind of wrapping up some stuff before Canada basketball. You suited up for the Canadian Masters squad in basketball at the Macabaya Games. Just describe that a little bit, because I know, you know, that's important. You're obviously a proud Canadian, but then, you know, you're representing your community and your faith as well.
Yeah, so it's something that, again, I just kind of fell into, and I don't want to make it sound like more than it is because I'm not a very good player. But the Maccabiah Games happen every 4 years in Israel, and I'm Jewish, and the simplest way to think of it is as a Jewish Olympics, but it's at different age groups too. There's like a U16 and a U18. There's an open, and then there's a Masters. I'm a Masters cause I'm old. So, I was asked to, put a team together for a charity basketball tournament 10, 11 years ago at Hoop Dome, complex in Toronto, which is actually co-owned, I believe, I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but co-owned, by Glenn Grunwald and a guy, Ted Badner, that I went to high school with. He was a year ahead of me, and he owns Hoop Dome. And so I was aware of it, and somebody said, hey, we're doing a charitable tournament. Can you put a team together and promote it a little bit? So I did a couple of interviews. I was on the flyer, whatever. So I got a bunch of my buddies that I had played with either in high school or intramural at university or men's league after. And we played, and amazingly enough, we made the finals. And we got beat pretty good in the finals. And then like a month later, I got a call from the, I guess he's the president of the Canadian Maccabee Association. And he said, we'd like you to help. Would you like to speak at a dinner? We'd like to raise money for this. We'd like to have you as a speaker. And I said, sure. And I went in for a meeting, and I walked in, and another guy at the meeting, I looked at him and he looked at me, and I said, didn't we just play you in basketball last month? And he said, yeah. And he said, after the meeting, he said, you want to come out and run with us on Tuesday night? And I said, all right. And like, these are guys, I guess, late 30s, early 40s at the time. So we went out and played, and I didn't even realize, I just went out for the run. And at the end of the run, he came up to me and he said, would you like to join our team? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. What team are we talking about? And so this is a Masters team. And every 4 years, there are games in Israel. And so I've been on the Canadian Masters team. And again, we have some great players. I am not one of them. I am there to set screens, use my elbows, use my fouls. And if I ever touch the ball, all three guards yell, give it to me right away. And I give it to them right away because they're the guys who can score. But I, you know what, it's been a great experience. Some of my closest friends are guys I've met through that. And over the last 10, 11 years, so I've played once in Brazil, twice in Israel. We typically win the bronze because the U.S. and Israel are just a little bit better than we are. But I've never been to Brazil before. And, you know, to get to go to Israel and play against Argentina, play against Russia, play against the U.S., you know, it's just great. It makes you feel like a kid again. You know, on the one hand, we're old men and what are you doing? This is silly, but it makes you feel like a kid again. And it's helped me keep in shape, which is not a bad thing when you're a middle-aged guy. So it's been a wonderful experience.
No, that's a cool story. And it caught my eye. So I appreciate you sharing that. Dan, obviously on Canada Hoops, we like to talk Canada basketball with our guests, especially with those who have played for Canada, or in your case, call games for Canada basketball. I know we can go pretty far back and deep with respect to the experiences and different memories that you have with the program and knowledge. But, you know, what sticks out the most for you so far? Just if you go even to 94, we talked about that, 2000, 2015, just some key moments for the program, maybe on a trajectory.
Yeah. So I will never claim to be as knowledgeable as someone like yourself and others are. I've listened to other episodes of your podcast, and I follow people on Twitter who are wonderful resources and wonderful sources of information. Right. I've always kind of been pulled, you know, there's Blue Jay me, and then there's Sunday Night Baseball me, and then there's college basketball me. And so there are times where I've missed out on things that I wish I knew more about. 94 was great. I back in 94, I did not know enough about the history of the program, the highs and lows, the pros and cons of the program. I was just there calling games. Right. You know, 2000, we remember them, you know, them going to the Olympics. And again, it's kind of unfortunately, there's so much, so close, but in this, on the men's side, if we're talking about the men's side right now, you know, you know, 2000's another example of that. They did well, but they were that close to doing even better. And then there's a period of a number of years where things just weren't going well. They just didn't have the talent, weren't getting enough players. 2015, so I did those games. Right. That was me and Leo, and that was for TSN, and we were sitting in a tiny little studio. We were not in Mexico. We were sitting in a tiny little studio, and again, you know, blew out Venezuela by 20 in the first round, looked great, and I haven't watched that game. I should watch that game back. I'm sure I could find it on YouTube or something, but you know, it just felt like they kind of got punked a little bit in the semifinal. Venezuela was an older, I mean, they're like Venezuela always is, right? They're older and they're tougher and they're meaner. And I mean that as a compliment. And they learned from their first game with Canada. They learned what they had to do and they did it. You know, Kelly Olynyk had a great game and didn't get enough help. And, you know, a questionable foul call at the end, which, by the way, as a play-by-play guy, was confusing as hell. We were sitting in a studio in Toronto, and it was really hard to know what was going on at the most important part of the game back then. So 2015 was obviously very painful. And as an aside, I had and have a clause in my various other contracts that says if the Canadian men's team qualifies for the Olympics, I can take time away from my other employers. And if I get hired, I can go do the Olympics. So like I was going to Rio until they lost that game. And I had been hired to do the job, but they had to make it in order for me to accept the job. So, but you know, felt for everybody in the program, felt for Jay Triano, felt for everybody. It was hard. And then probably the last 5-6 years is when I've really, really locked in. Like if they're playing the Virgin Islands, I'm on DAZN at, you know, 1:20 in the morning or whatever, to, you know, watching that game now. And I've gotten to know a lot more about the other players. I mean, not nearly as much as, you know, I heard your episode with Scott Witter, not nearly as much as you know and Scott knows, but I follow some of the international players a little bit more. Again, I see a lot of them coming up through college, but then they're gone. And if they're in the NBA, I still see them, but if they wind up overseas, I don't see them as much, but I'm doing a better job following them now. And, you know, it was great in the last go-round leading up to the World Cup, seeing, and you'll know what I mean, seeing our B and C players
right.
do well enough. You know, you can't get your best players because of the November window and the February window and all that. But seeing our next level of players and maybe even the next level of players do enough to get Canada into the World Cup. But then I was at the game. I don't want to mix up my time frames here, but I was at the game. They were playing. They had an exhibition game in Toronto when Kelly slipped and hurt his knee. Right. And he was going to go to China. And ultimately, I don't know how much of a difference that would have made, because in order to qualify for the Olympics right out of China, they would have had to have been one of the top two teams, one of the top two America's teams. That's hard. So, but China was hard because the guys who were there played so well, did everything they could, but they just didn't have enough talent, right? So, so now Victoria, and I'm sure I'm sure we'll talk about Victoria, which again, so close. You know, how can you get closer than they got? But all you can do, you know, listen, you're either in emotionally or you're out, right? Both as players and as fans or as broadcasters. All you can do is look forward to the World Cup in 23 and Paris in 24 and hope it has a different ending.
No, well put. And a couple of things I point out. I know I've heard you mention you're not a huge fan of the Windows qualifiers, and I don't think a lot of us are, but I do like the Windows qualifiers for the idea that we get to see some of these other guys, you know, make that commitment, come from overseas and play in these windows. I think that it's good for the program, and it's nice to see a lot of these guys. And I've had past guests who have done that, played in them, and you know, they value it, and we value them. Yep. So there's one positive, but the windows,
right?
FIBA wants to do what FIBA wants to do, but the other thing too, just with respect to Victoria, I think you know, positive. We're seeing more of an effort, more of a buy-in from guys to represent and play. I mean, the reemergence of Andrew Wiggins and Andrew demonstrated that he's a guy we need. He is a player we need to have on our team. It was nice to see him back playing for Canada. RJ's bought in. It seems like he really cares. What are your thoughts? Nick Nurse is recommitted. You know, there was an alleged summit at Summer League with guys that would play for Canada. So that looks positive. I think that's a good thing there. You know, Glenn Grunwald has decided to step down, and we've got Mike Bartlett taking over as CEO. So things look strong, you know.
Things do look strong, you know, not to go back too much again, but the pandemic hurt everybody in a million different ways, but it hurt Canada too, because as you well remember, if this had happened the year before, you know, you remember that 7-day period where Jamal, I'm in, Shea, I'm in, boom, 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 right? And then Jamal Murray gets hurt, and I don't focus as much on Jamal, because if Jamal had been healthy, Denver might have played long enough that he might not have been able to come to Victoria. And I think people overlook that sometimes.
Yeah.
But had Shea not gotten hurt, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, I believe, would have come. And it might have been enough. Like, if you're that close and you add Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, that might have been enough. But to be fair, Greece lost a bunch of guys to injury. Turkey didn't have Shane Larkin, who's a really good player.
Right.
But you got to give credit to the Czech Republic. You know, Tomáš Satoranský got on the plane, never went back, you know, was in Chicago, got on the plane, went and was great and made the shot that broke Canadians' hearts. But if I were a cigar smoker, the day that Nick Nurse said I'm in through 2024, I would have lit a cigar, but I don't smoke cigars. But figuratively, I lit a cigar, because I'm not sure any of us will understand the importance of having someone like Nick Nurse being the head coach of the program, because who's got more credibility with the NBA players than him? And it's fantastic. And you mentioned Andrew Wiggins and RJ Barrett. I think it's totally unfair for anybody to get on their case about how they played in Victoria. I thought they both played very well. I really agreed. Do. Yeah. Lou Dort and Nikhil Alexander Walker were studs, in my opinion. You've got four cornerstones right there. Dwight Powell, I love Dwight Powell. Absolutely love everything about Dwight Powell, right? Dwight Powell could have easily said, you know what, guys, I tore my Achilles last year and I just played a full season and I got to shut it down. And he didn't. So I think he got five mainstays right there. Hopefully he will stay in the program. We all know what Corey Joseph has done, Captain Canada, over the years. Right. And Corey is certainly a part of the program, but if you can get Jamal or Shea, never mind both, obviously your point guard position gets even stronger. And then you got to get some size. Look how big Greece is. Look how big Turkey is. Look how big the Czechs were. Look how big everybody is.
Right.
And the shame of it all is if Kelly Olynyk had been a free agent the year before or the year after, I like to think he would have been there. I mean, it was right in his backyard too, right? Yeah. And I'm not blaming Kelly. I haven't been in his situation. He's played for Canada so much. But if Kelly'd been there, I think they'd have gone to the Olympics. Now, I don't think they would have medaled, but I think they'd have gone to the Olympics and that there'd be a lot of great vibes and positive momentum. So I'm hoping Kelly will play next time, although I did take note of the fact that the Olympics are 3 years away and he signed a 3-year contract. I'm sure you took note of that fact as well. So
yes, we did. Yeah.
Yes. But will Zach Edey be ready by then? Will, I think it's Charles Bediako, who's going to Alabama this year. Will he be ready by then? In international ball, and Kem Birch is another one, right? Like Kem Birch just, and it's great for him the way that it's turned out. I'm so happy for him. But Kem Birch was really good in China, and Kem Birch would have given Dwight Powell a lot of help in Victoria. And that's not to take away from Trey Lyles. Trey Lyles has a spot on this team as well. They just needed more size. So I'm really, really hoping that some of the guys I mentioned will join the guys who were there. You don't need 12 NBA players, I don't think. And they had 8 or 9. You need the right players, and they need a little bit more at the point and a little bit more inside, I think, and then they should be good enough to qualify. But as you know, the FIBA qualification process is complicated, and in all likelihood, you're going to have to do it in one of these last chance tournaments unless you can have a great World Cup. So That's the thing. And I love hearing Nick Nurse say, hey, if you're not in, we'll talk to you in 2025. But I hope that turns out well, where the guys say, I want in badly enough that I'm going to give up two summers, not one.
Right. Well put by the legend, Dan Shulman. Dan, who is your top five of all time for Canada basketball?
This is hard. So, and again, I will admit to not being as knowledgeable as yourself and many others. To me, three are easy. Steve Nash, Corey Joseph, Kelly Olynyk. I think those are easy. I'm sure somebody would argue, but I mean, Steve Nash, it's obvious. And Corey Joseph and Kelly Olynyk have both played for Canada so much and at such a high level and all over the world that I think they belong there. So I thought about this a little bit because you gave me a heads up. And again, if I'm overlooking somebody obvious here, I apologize. But I'd like to celebrate some players who maybe aren't household names like the other guys, but have done a lot for the program.
Right.
And I couldn't cut it down to two. So I'm going to get my 5-man team is going to be a 6-man team, if that's
cool.
Okay.
Cool.
I am a huge fan of Kevin Pangos, Melvin Edgem, and Aaron Dornikamp. And I feel badly leading Brady Heslip out because I think Brady Heslip deserves a lot of credit as well. But these are the guys who were playing in Europe and had to travel 24 hours to get to Chile or the Philippines or wherever they were playing. And every time they got a phone call, virtually every time they got a phone call, they said yes. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that because a lot of them said yes, knowing that if the program ultimately got to where it wanted to get, there was no guarantee that they'd get the phone call that time. And to me, that takes a special kind of dedication to say, you know what, I'm going to fly from Spain to Chile, I'm just making it up, to play for 3 days now, even though they may not call me next summer when the stakes are higher. So I think guys like Pangos and Edgemon Dornikamp deserve a lot of credit.
Well, that's a great five and six men, and that's a first. I don't think anyone's ever shouted out Aaron Dornikamp in their group. And shout out Melvin Edgem, a friend of Canada Hoops, too. He's joined us. So I like it. That's a great six.
So who are the other guys, like after Nash and Joseph and Olenek? I would guess Tristan Thompson would get a lot of mention.
Yeah, a lot of people go a little old, and they give a lot of love to Leo. Jay Triano gets a lot of love, rightfully so. Carl English. You know, Carl.
All great choice.
Yeah, shout out Carl, my first guest. Man, there's so many. Joel Anthony. I mean, and I've said actually with other people in conversations, like, I don't know that I myself could do a five. It'd be really hard. I would need a roster almost, because there's so many great people, like you said.
Yeah, and maybe I've got a little recency bias there when I say Pangos and Edgem and Dornikamp, but I like all three of their games and everything I've ever heard. You know, about the people they are and the teammates they are and the dedication and the sacrifice. You know, even if Canada gets to a point where they could literally choose any 12 players they want and say yes, I hope there's a place. And Dornikamp's a little bit older, but I hope there's a place for that type of player. Melvin Edgem can help people. Kevin Pangos can help people on that team because of their... and Pangos is coming back to the NBA now, so it's a different story, but they can help people in international basketball. They have, you know, they've been there, done that more than anybody else. So, I've got a lot of admiration for guys like that.
Well put. And, you know, we appreciate that insight. Can we do a few, fun random questions? I think I got three for you, Dan.
Sure. I'll do my best.
What is the best place to call a game in college basketball with respect to the atmosphere and perhaps their tradition?
Allen Fieldhouse, Kansas. There are great ones. Cameron Indoor Stadium, Duke, phenomenal. Assembly Hall, Indiana, phenomenal. Mackey Arena, Purdue, phenomenal. But it's Allen Fieldhouse, Kansas. When you walk through the doors, Maddie, it feels like it's 1955. You feel like you've been transported back to another time. The noise, the energy, the tradition, even the Jayhawk logo on the middle of the court, it is awesome. I have wonderful, wonderful memories of going to Kansas.
I know you're a big Green Bay Packers fan. Who is your all-time favorite Packer?
It's probably, I mean, I love Aaron Rodgers. I do. It's hard not to. You know, he won a Super Bowl and has been a multiple time MVP, but it's probably the guy who got me into the Packers. And this is into the Wayback Machine, back into the 80s. The San Diego Chargers had a great wide receiver named John Jefferson, who I loved, and he got traded to the Packers. And that's why I became a Packer fan. I loved Jefferson so much that even though I was a Chargers fan, I went over to the Packers when Jefferson got traded to the Packers. So I think I've got to say him.
That's cool. Other than Toronto, you know, your home area, what is your favorite place in Canada?
That's a great question. I will give you two. I've been to Banff only twice, I think. But Banff, Alberta, I think, is one of the prettiest places I have ever seen in my life.
Right.
And one of my sons lives in Halifax. And I love Halifax. I think, and I've done a little, you know, a little roaming around in Nova Scotia when I've gone to see him. Haven't been able to do as much during the pandemic because the restrictions were really strict out there. That's the one I told you about who got married at the beginning of the podcast. So, right. But I would say Banff and Halifax are the first two places that come to mind.
Great answers. I can look out my window right now and pretty much see the mountains towards Banff. And then I got lots of love for Nova Scotia. My wife's from Cape Breton, so hits right on the spot. Dan, I know you made a lot of connections, you know, both personally and professionally through the career. Any shout outs or thank yous before I get you out of here?
Well, we mentioned Leo. I'll give a shout out to Leo. Leo and I have been friends for a long time, and back when I was young and didn't know a whole lot, he was partnered up with me for the World Championships, and I did some Raptors and Grizzlies games with him, and we've remained friends ever since. I want to give a big shout out to Leo, you know, and to some of the early people in my industry who did basketball. You know, a guy like John Saunders, the late John Saunders, who was a great guy, a friend of mine, and a great broadcaster. And when I used to see him in New York once or twice a year, at the Jimmy V doubleheader for the V Foundation, ESPN's charity, in memory of Jim Valvano, John Saunders was on the board of directors, and so he would host the pregame show and I would do the games. So we'd see each other in New York and always have like the little joke and the secret Canadian handshake joke, like there was no secret Canadian, but we had, right. You know, have people think that, you know, we just, even though we didn't see each other, hardly at all, just the fact that we were from the same area and both being down in the US, it was great to see him. And, you know, a more general one is, a lot of the college basketball coaches who I've bothered for time over the years, from Roy Williams to Bill Self to Mike Krzyzewski, whoever it is. Like, again, I'm just some Canadian kid who had a hoop on his driveway, who was a math major, who loved basketball. And the fact that I've been able and, you know, been lucky enough to go to Kentucky and Kansas and Duke and Carolina and do games, these college coaches are and the assistant coaches are amazing. And Tom Izzo's another one. I got to shout out Tom Izzo, who won't let me be in the gym for 5 seconds before he throws a Canada joke in my face. He's always, he thinks Canadians are hilarious. And I'm the butt of a lot of jokes from U.S. college coaches. Not as many now that Canada's producing so many great players. Right. Now it's like, hey, should we recruit up there more? Who do you hear about? And stuff like that. But, you know, I've been very lucky. That's been the world that I've been immersed in for the last 26, 27 years. Just want to thank all of them for giving this, you know, goofy, bald Canadian guy some time over the years.
Well, that's awesome. Well put. And listen, we really appreciate you joining us on Canada Hoops. All the best to you and your family, Dan. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we're looking forward to hearing you and seeing you on the Blue Jays for the rest of the year as well.
You as well, Maddie. Thank you. Keep doing the great work you're doing on Canada basketball. And we're all hoping for the same thing over the next 2 to 3 years.
Absolutely. That does it for the first episode of season 2 on Canada Hoops. What a way to get started. I want to thank the legend Dan Schulman for pulling up. Thank you for your support. Continue to like and share Canada Hoops. Keep spreading love for Canadian basketball. We will see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to Canada Hoops.